Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 123 of the Alexi Sale Podcast.
Calm down, audience, studio audience, please. Thank you.
My posse. Montague the dog. Calm down. Told you to calm that down, boy. You said you've had a lot more kind of comments on the film, really, and there's no reason why, film night has to, film club has to, be contained in one podcast. There's also somebody's pulled us up, I think, or made a comment about conversation about favorite supermarkets. I think I know what it is, and I think I feel bad about it. Do you want me to say what I think it is?
Yeah, go on.
We didn't mention the co-op.
That's, yeah. And the fact that we had the conversation at all.
Well, that seems to be overly prescriptive, really. You don't get to choose.
We've had a couple people mention the co-op, which is totally fair. And I think Debbie put it best in an email. She emailed alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Hiya, Alexi and Talal. Just a few comments stemming from your unusually mundane and therefore forgivable conversation about supermarkets. I thought it was hilariously mundane. A few weeks ago, Alexi mentioned a time when, for example, the Communist Party expected their members to try and live the values the party espoused, i.e., the personal is the political. So, with that in mind, and because we're all feeling powerless with regards to the genocide in Gaza, one of the things we can do is not buy Israeli goods. Of course, me and Alexi agree, and we assume that goes without saying. We're not in buying that shit. I'm always checking the origins of produce. Anyway, when talking about supermarkets, you forgot to mention the co-op, which is the only one, I think, to have banned Israeli goods. So please give them a mention. I know their hummus might not be as good as others. They've not got bad hummus. It's all right, actually. It's very bland. No risks, but nothing offensive either. But the co-op deserves some support. Thanks for the podcast. I do appreciate it. From fellow Scouser, Debbie. Debbie. Thank you. That was Debbie, everybody.
I feel absolutely gutted. I'm tempted to commit seppuku, to eviscerate myself with a dagger because of not mentioning the co-op. It's unforgivable. I'd understand if you unsubscribe. It's an unforgivable omission. The co-op, my nearest co-op is in the Gray's Inn Road and is Linda was saying that they're not really in the. I mean, I think co-ops have more personality than a lot of supermarkets. Really, that they're often like completely out of things, or they've only got Sprouts and stuff. They're really quite eccentric. There's a homeless guy. Is into his like second or third year, I think, outside the co-op, and he's maybe Eritrean or Sudanese or something. So he's also a permanent. He's hanging on in there.
His one's a bit chaotic in the co-op, and the staff, bless them, have to wear this like 3-piece jogger suit. They seem quite overwhelmed with everything. They're quite understaffed,
I think our co-op's got better, actually. But also, I did meet the woman. I don't know if she's left or we met a very nice woman at Medical Aid for Palestinians. Who was the head of the co-op, and I think had major plans for both selling Palestinian goods and also not stocking Israeli goods. I don't know whether she's recently left. I'm not sure, but co-op. Yeah. I remember the one in, Hebden Bridge had amazing curries from sort of Yeah, so I think the Hebden Bridge is actually twinned with Gus.
I used to work at the co-op.
Did you?
Yeah, my local growing up, when I was a teenager, was on Pitshanger Lane in Ealing.
Very pretty street.
And before it got bought by the co-op, it was called Balfour News. And I used to do the paper round for them.
Is that the same people as the Balfour Declaration? Was it owned by the same family that created the problem of the Zionist state?
Yeah. And ironically, the co-op came and occupied their storefront. But yeah, I did their paper round. I used to do it on my scooter. And I was very overweight as a teenager. I was a young tweenager, really big, chunky boy. And my little micro scooter had a bow. It was like bowed. It was bent in the middle because the Saturday papers, when I had to deliver the Saturday papers, I'd have two big fat bags around both shoulders, slung over my shoulders. And I just remember going down the hill and the bottom of my scooter scraping on the road.
When you say scooter, you mean one of those little things with little wheels
push
that
one.
You push along, Yeah.
But then I ended up working at Balfour News behind the counter. Yeah. And then I was there while it transitioned into a co-op. And I've got nothing but good things to say about them.
Yeah. So anyway, apologies to everybody. When I was young, the few jobs I have, nobody ever put me in a public-facing role.
No.
Really. They would always put me in the back room or
It was quite an easy transition from that to bar work, actually. That's where I guess I got my start with that kind of thing.
Yes,
I know. Like flaring the cigarette packets until I realized I was in the wrong job.
What is flaring? I don't know what flaring
is. Like when you juggle bottles.
Oh, right.
But I was doing it with chocolate bars and cigarettes. Little bar humor there.
Is that what's that film Cocktail? Is it Mel Gibson and Tom Cruise?
It's not Mel Gibson. It's another Australian, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah. I like that film.
Anyway, should we? Charming as these reminiscences are,
Brian Brown.
What's happened to him?
He's 78 years old.
All right, getting on a bit then, yeah.
He's got a grandchild. Congratulations, Brian.
Well.
And he's a native Australian. I'm not going to dig any deeper than that. Yes, thanks for all your correspondence last week for the podcast. And please keep sending it in and send in your suggestions for Alexi Reacts, our weekly reaction show exclusively on the Patreon, where Alexi watches shit he's done and he reacts to it. Last week we did Albert Einstein,
the wilderness years.
And you kept calling him Epstein throughout the episode, and I was so confused.
Did I?
Yeah.
I didn't know. Didn't know I was doing that. Well, so people have got one thing I wanted to mention about, which is very, is that one thing I'd forgotten to mention about Touch of Evil is the way when the cars stop out, they continue to bounce up and down because there's a, American cars of that era, they're incredibly softly sprung. So they kind of boing, 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 which was just something that I noticed really.
Is that because the roads were so bad, like they had to be?
No, I think it was more that, they prioritized kind of smooth ride or soft ride over everything else, really. So American cars were, I don't know about today, but, certainly up until like the 80s or 90s, were all famously terrible to drive, really. They had they were very, very softly sprung, big engine up the front kind of thing. Often quite primitive suspension, solid rear suspension and stuff. And that's the way one of the ways that European cars got into the US market was just by being so much better to drive, so much more dynamic. And,
I'd love to give one a go, though.
Those 50s things, yeah.
Yeah. they're always like, they steal the show. Any of those throwback American films like Grease or American Graffiti or something where they, an Americana 1950s film, the cars steal the show every time.
Yeah. Well, it was, it was
so much character. That's why are cars so boring? Why do they, all cars have to look the same and be so bland and boring?
It's partly, safety. So you're against stopping children being mown down, aren't you, by?
Yes, that's what I said. Yeah.
I think it's partly aerodynamics that really there's only one, effective aerodynamics mean cars tend to all be the same because there's only one optimal aerodynamic shape. It's also safety. Obviously, a big bluff front bumper is much more dangerous than one that is kind of sculpted so when it strikes a pedestrian, they roll onto the bonnet or the hood, as it were, and rather than being just smashed by this solid kind of wall of metal that slams into them. So it's SUVs, like Range Rovers and stuff, are much more dangerous for pedestrians, because you've got that just big bluff front, really. And more dangerous to people in other cars, if you want to be safe, you buy an SUV, buy a big four-wheel drive, but it means that you will obliterate everybody else around you. It's also about safety, and they do all kind of look, I don't know. I mean, because I'm retired from the motoring journalism business, but they do all kind of tend to look the same these days.
Right? Yeah,
particularly obviously all the Chinese brands, Geely's and BYD and Omo. I mean, they all look
well. That does make sense. MG. I suppose. Very pragmatic answer there.
Yeah, actually, that's one thing react to is that series I did for BBC Two called Drive, which was about how to drive properly, how to drive safely. I made in the 90s, I think.
Oh, and was it tongue-in-cheek or were you seriously trying to spread awareness?
It was humorous, but it contained elements of humor, but it was serious. It was a serious attempt. I was annoyed that they didn't show it more, really.
That's great. I will look that up. Oh, back on the consumerism topic, just real quick. I have recently I subscribed to a magazine called Ethical Consumer. It got pushed to me on probably an Instagram advert or something. But is it an established thing? Do you know it? Have you heard of it?
No.
But you can guess what it is.
Yeah, I can guess what it is.
It's like Which magazine, but for ethics.
Yeah.
And they'll pick a different category, like it will be sun cream or electric vehicles. And then they'll just, or holiday agencies, holiday booking agencies. And then they'll list them in order of how ethical they are. And one of the main categories that they, in the last couple of years, have included in every ranking is their stance on Palestine or how much they help.
Yeah.
If they have business in Israel, if they have a store in Israel, then that makes them lose points, And I recommend it. It's good.
Yeah.
It's been quite helpful, actually, especially now. They're very clever. The last issue was sun cream and holiday. This is the time of year you're thinking about booking a holiday in or something. And so now I know, which websites to definitely avoid when looking at booking.
There was a Neil Street in Covent Garden. There was an Israeli cosmetics company there. I can't remember which one it was now, but the people would stand outside offering samples, and Linda would regularly give them earache about genocide.
Good honor.
And ethnic cleansing, yeah.
Is that like Sephora or something?
Wasn't that? I can't remember what it was. That must
CeraVe.
I can't remember.
Ahava Sabon, Moroccan oil. And Christina Cosmeceuticals.
No, none of those. We used to do like Dead Sea. Body scrub and shit. I don't know.
And you were talking about the film there.
Yeah.
We had one comment on YouTube. That guy Thanos said, didn't get to watch the film. I'll watch it sometime.
Thanks. I don't know. That's the kind of can't do spirit we really appreciate here on on the Alexis Help podcast.
We had a couple people message about Heston, Charlton Mexican, or Mexican yeah. Heston, saying he was quite left-wing in his younger years, and he even stood beside Martin Luther King during one of his speeches.
Right.
And so he was one of those guys who transitioned as he got older, like you suspected.
Being that right-wing. Yeah, it's weird that.
So, you know, that's a shame that people can do go that way, don't they?
Like, yeah.
I don't see the appeal in turning coat like that.
No. I'm very happy with my...
James commented on patreon.com/AlexisHelpPodcast. In the comment section there, James says, a nice story about that opening scene that you talked about. So you told us last week, Alexi, that they were filming till sunrise because the border guard couldn't get his lines right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's such a long, complicated, almost 4 minute long camera shot. And he's like just over halfway through it and he kept fucking up his lines. I can imagine how many times he had to reset the entire thing. A nice story about that opening scene is that someone asked Wells why he didn't replace the actor playing the border guard who kept getting his lines wrong. And Wells replied, I couldn't. It would destroy him.
Ah. Yes, I still haven't watched the second half of that documentary, really, but he does come across as... I always thought he was a bit of a kind of tyrant, really. There's that famous recording, isn't there, of him railing. He's doing a voiceover for Peas, I think, over here. And he's giving the people in the booth a terrible time.
That's his later years, surely.
Yeah. Yeah, but he just come across on that. It's unusual. He comes across on that documentary. He's been a much nicer person than I had imagined.
Well, a passionate artist like that, who's, you know, got tumultuous a temper. You know, they're going to have some really good ways they express their passion, and some really bad ways they do it. That's quite. As an Arab, I can relate, you know, we're very passionate people.
We're passionate
we love
people,
too hard and we hate too hard. The film, James continues, is also a reminder that Wells was never afraid to be trashy, to mix trash and high culture.
Yeah.
Also, there's an interview in which Heston says if he did it again, he would do a slight accent. Thank God he didn't.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
And also...
I'm going to see that.
Yeah, right. But, you know, he's already painted his face brown.
Yeah.
Maybe the accent would be some sign of kind of respect to what he's portraying. Oh, my God. It does kind of remind me of, you know, the amount of times I've seen people being cast as Arab when they are Pakistani or Iranian.
Or even white Jews from Liverpool.
White Jews from Liverpool or Bangladeshi. Yeah. But those South Asian ones and, you know,
this
white director is like, cool, you're perfect. Just do it in your own accent. And so they're doing it in an Indian accent or a South Asian accent, excuse me. And I'm just like, you're just educating the world incorrectly about what Arabs sound like. You know, and if they have Arabic dialogue, they learn it phonetically. And
right.
So they're saying Arabic words in a really poor way that, and with an Indian accent. It's a very confusing and infuriating thing to see.
It's one of the weird things that when I've had to learn a bit of foreign, I always remember it forever.
Oh, yeah.
Like in the film, I can't speak Spanish, but in the film Siesta, I had to say, Te puedo llevar al centro, pero se cobra más los domingos. I can take you to the center, but it'll cost more on Sundays. Or in the film of Whoops Apocalypse.
You got manis.
You got manis. The film of Whoops. Zivat Amerikanski Jinlistov. Nada ich liquidiero vok. I think.
Huh. Hello. Would you like to join
there
that
There are
again?
Two American journalists. They need to be liquidated immediately.
Is that a line of yours?
Yeah, from the film Whoops Apocalypse, the film of Whoops Apocalypse.
Oh. And is that German?
Zwar zwut amerikanske journalistov, nade ich liquidere wof strazuje.
Do you play a German in that film?
No, Russian.
Russian. Well, right.
Supposed to be Russian.
Yes, of course.
Learned phonetically, but I'm sure it's terrible. Just a quirk. I remember the. Like, I don't remember. I don't remember the lines in English, or I even didn't remember them when I was supposed. I was actually filming them, but for some reason the lines I'd learned in foreign languages I could do perfectly. Te puedo llevar a centro pedos a cobrar malos domingos.
I did it
with an Andalusian accent.
I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. When I was like 10 years old, I did an advert for the Saudi Arabian market, an advert for milk. And I still remember the line perfectly.
Yeah.
And it was even in a Saudi dialect, which is very different to the Syrian dialect.
Yeah.
It was يقولوا الخبرات انك تقدر تشرب 15,000 علبة حليب بحياتك بس مين رح يستنى. And the scientists say that you can drink 15,000 cartons of milk in your lifetime. But who's going to wait a lifetime? And then the camera zooms out and you see this fat kid. Remember I mentioned how fat I was as a kid. The camera zooms out and I'm sitting on a literal mountain of milk cartons. Because I drank them all and got really fat. Yeah.
That sort of seems to imply different kind of cultural priorities apart from anything. Else, I mean, how odd.
What do you mean?
Also, drinking milk in the Middle East is a bit of a weird thing to do, isn't it?
What are you talking about?
I don't know. Doesn't it go off quickly? I don't know.
They have fridges.
I see you drinking iron. I can see you drinking, you know, yogurt-based drinks.
Drinking milk
in the Middle East, I would never drink milk.
Well, I think they would yogurtize their milk really quick. Before refrigeration was a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
Yeah.
You drink your coffee black and strong and concentrated. Yeah. And in Mongolia, they would ferment their milks. Is that the same as making it a yogurt? No.
I don't think so. I'm interested to know what. No, I think it's different.
Fermenting is alcoholic, isn't it?
That's supposed to be very good for you, though. I don't know. You can't get drunk on kimchi. No matter how much you. This is very poor, isn't it?
This is great. All right, Paul comments, greatly enjoyed your Touch of Evil discussion. It was made in 1958. Thus, Wells put Janet Leigh in an isolated, dodgy motel 2 years before Hitchcock did with Psycho.
Yeah.
That's the same woman from Psycho.
Yes.
Doing a very similar story.
Yes, true.
It is possible that Hitchcock or Psycho's screenwriters took some inspiration from this scenario and casting. Is it further possible that Dennis Weaver...
It stinks in here.
Is it possible that Dennis Weaver's, I agree with Talal, hopelessly overplayed night manager character had some impact on them in the creation of Norman Bates from Psycho? Wells went on to cast Anthony Perkins as the central character, Joseph K.
The Trial. Kafka's The Trial.
Correct. Released 2 years after Psycho. Perhaps Perkins got typecast, but his portrayal of Joseph K. is a little bit Norman Batesy. Feel free to discuss. Alexia's Joe Grandy would be perfection, especially in the radical theatre adaptation. I'm going to persuade Talal to make a future project when I next see him. After a live podcast.
So, no, I'd be Hank Quinn and I'd be the Wells role. No,
that would make more sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, focusing on him a little bit, I think. So I did say in the description on Patreon, I was like, come on, Mark, I want to hear your review. Mark Cunliffe, our in-house film critic. This was my first time watching the reconstructed version, and wow, To think I thought the theatrical cut had a great sense of movement, this version absolutely glides thanks to Wells' progressive visual approach. Now I need to know, I need to watch both versions to see the differences. From the use of camera cranes and the single take tracking shot to the remarkable cross-cutting and character-driven camera angles and composition, Wells propels the action at a fair lick, and the soundscape is equally...
Yes, it's true.
You know, serves to stress the urgency as much as the visuals, with overlapping dialogue. Seems to imply we have no time to waste and characters taking turns to speak. I like that. He likes the rock and roll, the brassy rock and roll music. I just want to skip to the next paragraph, which is where I think, yes, I like this bit. What remains clear in any version is the way Wells approaches his tale as a metaphorical bullfight. With his corrupt cop Quinlan, a grotesque and heavy-set antagonist standing in for the bull, and Charlton Mexican's Vargas serving as the matador, the latter, with his black and white sense of justice, challenges the fearsome bull, eventually trapping him in a ring that was ultimately of the former's own making. Yet, as with the cruel spectacle of the bullfight, there is some sympathy to be had for the ritualistic downfall of the defeated, which speaks to the fascination that the liberal Wells had with the seductive nature of corruption and the ethical compromises that one makes in life. Thank you, Mark. As always, so beautifully written.
Yeah, crikey.
Brilliant analysis.
Yeah.
Bullfights. And once I read that, I was like, I couldn't unsee it. It is.
I guess, yeah. He's tormenting this kind of creature. Yeah.
One little poke at a time, you know, death on a thousand wounds. Driving him back to alcohol, driving him back to his brothel, making him paranoid and angrier and angrier and angrier until finally the tragic kind of, you know, the very sad death at the end.
Yes. I wonder, I imagine that, I guess Wells being kind of quite macho in a way, that he was a devotee of Hemingway, I don't know really. Being, you know, the Sea World's greatest devotee of the corrida, bullfight. Of course, it is interesting. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but and I'm in no way am I a fan of bullfighting. I'm obviously always been an advocate for animal rights, and was quite involved maybe a couple of decades ago in various animal rights charities. There was a TV channel in Spain called, I think, La Casa de Hunt. I always was convinced that if English people came into a Spanish bar, they would immediately put that channel on, which is just, you know, it's a hunting channel. It was just, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, they would do it just to upset us, really. But of course, the interesting thing about, if you can call it a sport, you know, whatever bullfighting is, it is also, it's a ritual sacrifice, really, and it comes from a very, very, very ancient time that the matador in his suit of lights is the sun, and the bull is the human, is the sacrifice, not human sacrifice, but is the animal sacrifice to make the sun rise every day, and so you've got this sport, you know, in which these roots go right back to, you know, well beyond pre-Christianity. I mean, pre-agriculture, really, which is not to excuse bullfighting, but that is what the bullfight is, really.
Horrible. Yes, of course. When you said it, I don't know if it's a sport or not, I was going to interrupt and say, I think it's more of a ritual, but... You went ahead.
Yeah, it's a religion.
And
it's
said
a,
it yourself.
Animal sacrifice.
Yeah. Surely, there's no excusing what bullfighting became when it became, you know, corporatized
and that romanticism that people like Hemingway had for it, I think is disgusting.
Well, that even then, you know, nowadays, you know, how we look down on hunters and poachers and you know, sports hunters. But
just the worst 50s. People in the fucking world. I mean, hunters.
People didn't feel that way 80 years ago, you know, would they? It's a quite a recent phenomenon that we care.
Yeah. Yes. But it was always horrible. But I think people did. Some people did. But I mean, hunting is just the most, it's the most repellent. If anybody wants to come on and defend that. The most repellent thing, I think, in this modern age. Actually, that's one of the things I've been meaning to mention for a while. You know, when came about when the Israeli authorities banned the Palestinian flag, and so people just started displaying pictures of watermelons because they contain the colors of Palestine, which are red, white, green, and black. Do you know what else? So if they ban watermelons, you know what we can turn to next? The dartboard.
Ha!
The dartboard is the symbol of Palestine.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then you could have a dart in 19, a dart in 4, and a dart in 8.
Yes, that was commemorating the Nakba.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Luke Littler, I know, thinks deeply about Middle Eastern affairs. You know that darts champion who looks like 50 and he's like 18 or something, isn't he?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the dartboard is also a symbol of Palestinian liberation.
That. Did you think of that all on your own?
I did, yeah. That's my job.
It. I love that. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, let's see where we can go with that.
Maybe that could, I'm making a note of it. I'm going to action whatever this is. Make some merch. Make some dartboard t-shirts.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the art of the people are throwing darts into Palestine is or the symbol of that. I don't know where we go with that, really. That doesn't quite track, as it were.
Yeah. Could you draw in the darts as like missiles or something?
Really, the dartboard should be firing darts outwards,
yeah.
Outwards. So perfect. Anyway, I offer that. I offer that. So. I had a very nice weekend. I was going around the country. Well, I did some comic strip screenings and then question and answer events. I was in Dartmouth on Friday, Bridport on Saturday, and then Lewes in Sussex on Sunday. Me and Peter, the guiding spirit of the comic strip, Peter Richardson, we had a little road trip. People were tremendously excited to see us in 2 out of 3 of those places. I think the venue in the beautiful art center in Lewes on where the old Harvey's Brewery is, right by the railway station. The room was, because it was a really nice plush cinema in there, but it wasn't a good room for kind of live interaction, really, I think, in some way.
Right.
But there was hundreds of people there, and it was very, and everybody was very nice, and it's a beautiful art center. Of course, Lewes being there, and actually, we never got to talk about, you know, Lewes is the world, is the center of Protestant fundamentalism, you know.
Is it?
They celebrate bonfire. Everybody in everybody in Lewes is in a firework club, and then bonfire night in Lewes is the 7 clubs, I think. I mean, I'm sure somebody from Lewes will be listening to this and they can fill us in. They board up all the shops and then roll flaming barrels of tar down the streets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like Spain, and, you know.
I've been to that a few times.
Oh, right. Well, there you go. Well, you can tell me then.
Well, it seems I'm completely misinformed because I always assumed there was paganistic.
It's probably got pagan roots. But burning Guy Fawkes is clearly an act of Protestant supremacy, isn't it? Because you're burning the Catholic. Bonfire Night is about rejection of Catholicism and assertion of Protestantism.
Right. But now in Lewes, the effigy is not. Maybe they have a Guy Fawkes as well, but they always have a kind of a topical effigy
that
changes each year. And that's kind of takes the focus, really. So I've forgotten about that. It's been
a while. Maybe Lewes, it isn't. I don't know how. I'm interested. Somebody could tell us about the roots of what goes on in Lewes. But I know Bonfire Night, in its general sense, was about, you know, burning, you know, a rejection of Catholicism and the Cato Street plots and the attempt to restore Britain to Catholicism.
Okay.
I noticed because they do that a lot in Spain, and there was a fucking Israelis getting whiny because there was a small town in Spain that chose to burn an effigy of Benjamin Netanyahu this year. It's anti-Semitism.
Lewis is part of the Sussex bonfire tradition. There are seven societies putting on six separate processions. There is more, you know, I went to uni in Brighton and I lived there a bit longer after that. So, you know, we used to go because it was a laugh and we'd go and get drunk and drink scrumpy and watch the procession. I never dug into the history of it. So, yes.
Is it to do with our Protestant martyrs as well?
I'm sure there's something there, but I want someone at home to write in because I don't want to sit here and read this whole Wikipedia page in the podcast.
No,
unless you want me to.
No, I'd like you. This is a two-way street. I want to
get someone at home to. Yes. Yeah. All right. Email in to alexslpodcast@gmail.com if you have an authoritative knowledge of the Lewis bonfire nights. We'd love to know about that. You know, people were writing in suggestions as well for what you and Nigel could do for your...
Oh, yeah, try and get some of that fucking... Because did I say fucking Adrian's got a thing now? He's going bird watching with bloody Sam West, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very birding bitter about
is
that.
Growing and, I don't know, it's becoming like a thing. It's very trendy at the moment. I liked birds before it was cool. Yes. And people have written in because you were saying you and Nigel did the road trip and you had no on-screen chemistry, even though you're very good friends and you're very old friends. Well, someone said, obviously they should do cycling, but that might be a bit too active and physically demanding.
Yes, Nigel.
Long shoot days of cycling.
Yeah. There was one, wasn't there, fucking that Cockney guy and his son who was in EastEnders. They had a cycling show.
I had a really good suggestion from Anthony down in Brighton, funnily enough. We have 5 mini golf courses here in Brighton. Perhaps they could play all of them and demonstrate they do have on-screen chemistry in the right circumstances, unless they hate mini golf. I don't know. If you hate mini golf, might make it even better.
Yeah.
Alcohol is allowed on all the courses. And it could be called Alexi and Nigel's Crazy Golf Smackdown.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
I would fucking watch the shit out of that.
Yeah.
And it would be so funny if you actually, not you personally, but if the show, you know, through editing, takes the mini golf really seriously and keeps the scores and actually like tracks your scores and you have an ongoing tournament, but you and Nigel couldn't give two shits about it and you're just chatting shit. And
you could talk about the symbolism of all the windmill and
the robotic dinosaurs and King Kong, but each episode at a different miniature golf course in a different part of the country.
That's genius. Email that to, I think he's called Ben Frau, I think, at Channel 5. Email him immediately.
Can I be executive producer, please?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, wicked. Does that mean I don't have to do much, but I get paid?
It varies, doesn't it?
What is the difference? Executive producer?
I remember on my last TV series, I was executive producer, which meant I just got that credit, executive producer, nothing else.
Yeah.
It can be, executive producer can be, I mean, you know, you're central to the project, or it can mean just a meaningless...
Yeah.
Bauble, as it was with me on Merry-Go-Round.
There's a... you do notice when a series... If you're watching a series, by like series 4...
Yeah,
or even series 3,
yeah.
The star now is a producer on it.
Yeah.
And that just means what? They get to pick their own hair and makeup and their own assistant.
I don't know if it means anything at all. Maybe they get more money, but often it's just a...
You're going to have to earn your
just
stripes.
Just try and make them seem more.
It's an ego thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nothing else to it. It was with you, yeah, you admit
I'm
it.
Very pathetic it was, too.
What are you watching at the moment? Anything new that you're watching?
I quite like this series, Laid. It's based on an Australian series of the same name. It's about, I think it stars a, I think she's Chinese-American, I think, but I think she's a stand-up. It's also got Zosia Mamet, David Mamet's daughter, who, you know, that one obviously one decries nepotism. She is a very good performer, I think. Mm. I hate David Mamet.
About a woman
who's everybody who she's ever had sex with dies or is dying.
Whoa.
So that was quite good. What else did we? I just rewatched season three of Fargo, actually, which I thought was. I'm a fan of. I'd like to find series. I think it was four, which was about black gangsters and starred Chris Rock and yes. Timothy Olyphant. I can't seem to find it anywhere. I mean, anybody's got any suggestions? Series five was awful, I thought, of Fargo. It had John Hamm as a kind of evil. The evil rancher kind of dude, and it was way outside his range. I mean, John Hamm is a great performer, you know, but evil rancher dude is really outside his a bit range of abilities.
It's like is he just doing like a Jeff Bridges impression?
Yeah, but he hasn't got that. You know, Jeff Bridges has got that gnarly quality, and the evil rancher. You know, there's been evil rancher dudes, I think, in other series of. Of Fargo that have been, but it's just John Hamm is completely unbelievable on a horse.
No, that's a shame.
John Hamm cannot sit on a horse convincingly.
Did you watch his remake, kind of remake, not really, of Fletch?
No, I did not. I didn't know he'd done it, really.
Yeah,
Chevy Chase, or is it, or Dan Aykroyd, or one of those?
It was Chevy Chase.
Chevy Chase, right.
Chevy
it's
Chase
that
originally.
Guy, it's Carl Hyerson, isn't it? The guy who lives in Miami and used to write all the crime fiction about Miami and was quite an early, always mentioned the kind of ecological disaster that Florida is.
That's right. So I didn't even know it was based on books, a series of books.
Mm.
But yes, there were these like modern crime mystery novels about this he's not even a detective, he's like a freelance journalist, investigative journalist,
right,
that's
right,
it
right.
Called Fletch. Yeah, the what's his name, Chevy Chase films back in the early 80s, they weren't exactly incredibly loyal to the books. It was Chevy right. Chase using it as a vehicle to showcase his slapstick tomfoolery, so it kind of veered away from what the books are really actually like. It became a much more visual humor than the clever, witty, verbose kind of, you know, Aaron Sorkin style humor that the books displayed. But then John Hamm recently did 4 years ago, Confess Fletch, it's called.
All right.
I enjoyed it. My girlfriend didn't. I thought it was quite clever and funny as hell. I thought that's the kind of role John Hamm suits.
Right.
Fast talking, you know, he's got that Mad Men essence, but he's allowed to, he's clearly a very funny guy. I've heard him on a lot of podcasts and he has got a really good sense of humor.
Yeah.
And this allowed him to kind of showcase that a bit. I can't see him as a dude ranch kind of villain, but yeah, I really liked Confess Fletch. If you like noir stuff.
Yeah, all right.
It's about kind of art, art crime, art thief, art thieves, art thieves. There it is. There's a V in there. I forgot there was a V. And it's really good. And they wanted to make a franchise out of it, but I don't think it did well enough, which I'm kind of upset about.
Yeah.
But my point was, since Mad Men, yeah, he's been trying, clearly
yeah,
trying
he's
to.
A lot of interesting work. He was brilliant in 30 Rock, for instance.
Nothing's really taken off for him, I feel.
You got Your Friends and Neighbours, I think, has gone to a second series. I mean, I quite like the first series, but I wouldn't want to. I thought that was probably enough of that, really.
I didn't see that. Well, my heart bleeds for John Hamm. I hope he finds happiness.
I don't know, let's see if we can reach out to him, see if he wants to.
I'd love that. Right.
I think we've done enough.
I think we've done enough. Look, I want to just please once more implore our listeners to head to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast and support the show. Even £3 a month, you know. Do it for a few months and enjoy the Alexi Reacts that are on there, and watch Alexi, Lisa and Nigel watch the young ones. Me and Alexi go to a gun range and shoot guns. Fucking, that's really surreal that that exists, but it does, and it's on the Patreon, and there's a nice chat room in there. Send us your suggestions for Alexi Reacts. What should Alexi react to next? I think we're going to watch some stuff today, some more stuff.
I think we are, yeah.
Yep, a film critic strike. Also, we got some live shows on the 2nd of May in Wellingborough at the Diggers Festival. We're playing at 7:15 up there. Alexi's interviewing Slavo Žižek in the Barbican on the 6th of May. That must be sold out by now, surely.
I don't know.
You don't know? You don't know.
It's not mine.
I think in July, we're playing Shoreham's Rope Tackle again, doing an live Alexi Sale podcast there. And very excitingly, we're playing the Roundhouse Comedy Festival, 2nd of August. Interviewing, I think I can announce it now, we have special guest Diane Morgan on stage with us in the big, massive Roundhouse Theatre in Camden, 2nd of August. It's a massive room. If we don't sell out, we'll feel like absolute Muppets. Please buy tickets to that. 2nd of August at the Roundhouse.
If I wasn't interviewing Diane Morgan, I would go. I would buy a ticket to that. I might buy a ticket anyway.
Mm.
That just sounds like the best thing ever.
It's a matinee, so you can go out and get pissed after.
Or buy shit in Camden Market.
Go shopping for, well, it used to be all goth clothes and rock and roll stuff. It's all, I kid you fucking not, I was there the other day. 3 shops I walked past, exclusively selling Taylor Swift and Harry Styles t-shirts.
No.
God, this is an outrage. Camden used to be where the cool kids went.
Yeah.
The little, not even the cool kids, the weird freaks, the goth kids and the rock kids, you know, me and my mates buying our favorite rock band on a t-shirt, getting mugged on the high street. Now it's just overpriced. It's all owned by one rich Arab guy, apparently, who's just fucking converted everything to just paint by numbers, high street shit. Don't get me started.
No. All right, I won't.
All right, that'll do.
All right, everybody. Bye-bye. You've been listening to the Alexi Sale podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.